Hello, and thanks for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast, a series exploring the investment philosophies and journeys of some of Australia's leading investors and financial thinkers. I'm Owen Raskovich, founder of the Rask Group. For show notes and other episodes in this series, as well as free educational resources, please visit www.raskfinance.com. Before we go on, it's important to remember the Australian Investors Podcast is provided for educational purposes only and should not be relied upon to make an investment, financial, or taxation decision. The information included in this podcast does not take into account your needs, goals, or objectives, and guests appearing on the show may have a financial interest in some of the products mentioned. Please read all the important disclosure documents and refer to the Rask Group's Financial Services Guide on the Rask Finance website. Stephen McCarthy is Portfolio Manager at DMX Asset Management. Stephen is a qualified CPA and a passionate value investor. Prior to DMX, Stephen spent time as an expert company valuer, working on mergers and acquisitions and in insolvency. Stephen is known for his investments in quality small companies on the Australian Stock Exchange. So we spend time talking about his journey to finance, his investment beliefs, philosophy and process, as well as some of the most common mistakes made by small company investors. At the end of the episode, Stephen answers my favourite question with one of the best answers so far. Please enjoy this conversation with Stephen McCarthy of DMX Asset Management. Okay, Stephen, thanks for joining me on the show.
Thanks for this opportunity.
I'm going to start it off a bit differently in this episode. I want to know, what type of car do you drive?
Yeah, I drive an old 2013 V-Dub Golf, great.
Okay, great, an old V-Dub. And your colleagues?
Yeah, so Roger Collison gets around in an old Honda.
All right.
And Simon Turner, a Mazda CX-5.
So great, so very functional cars.
Very, very functional, very practical.
Yes. Wonderful. All right, for listeners, I'll fill you in on some of the details of that later in the show. But first, as usual, we'll start with your history, Stephen. And I believe you grew up in New Zealand and you studied a double degree at the University of Auckland. I suppose, where did the passion for finance come from?
Yeah, look, as a growing up, always had an interest in news, current affairs, reading the newspaper. And as a teenager, I guess that sort of progressed to reading the business section of the newspaper. Mm-hmm. Really keen to follow companies' stories and corporate developments. And yeah, at that time started scouring the share tables in the newspaper, mm-hmm. obviously pre-internet.
Yep.
And yeah, that interest led me to buying my first share at the age 18.
18, yeah, great.
It was a New Zealand company, Corporate Investments. Mm-hmm. Owned a collection of assets, including Montana Wines, and they're doing interesting stuff, doing interesting deals. And that company was actually taken over 3 or 4 years later, so it was actually a pretty successful first investment.
Yeah, great. Most people sell out at the first sign of a gain. That's a 3-year holding period. Wonderful.
Yeah. Yes, and then so just through university at the time, in New Zealand, there was a scheme, the student loan scheme, where you could mm-hmm. actually, at the time, you borrow funds from the government, and there was no restrictions, so you could apply those funds however you wanted. So I was able to use some of those funds to invest in the market, and again, it had some reasonable success, and was able to pay from the proceeds a fair chunk of my university fees.
Oh, really? That's great. Okay, so you could get this money and was it interest-free?
It was interest-free at the time, yeah.
Oh, yep. Great.
Obviously, it's subsequently been changed,
yep. and
a bit more tightened up, but it was an opportunity at the time to take advantage of.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, let's jump forward a little bit to your first job post-uni. Was it at an insolvency firm?
Correct, yes.
I imagine you were getting your hands dirty, applying some of the things that you learned at school or at uni. Can you tell us more about that and what the types of things that you were doing?
Yeah, so in insolvency, it's a tough game, and it's you're dealing with pretty emotional situations. You've got shareholders who have lost a lot of money, families have lost their businesses, creditors have lost money, employees have lost their jobs. So it's it's pretty tough situations to deal with, but. Look, it really made me focus on the importance of cash flow. Mm. And if you've a small business that has more cash going out than coming in, it's not going to be around for very long.
Yeah,
so cash flow, cash management, absolutely critical. And to this day, I always invest in businesses that are cash flow positive.
We'll get to that in just a moment, but I can definitely see that borne out in some of the positions that you have in the portfolio and some of your commentary. So you worked there for a few years, and then again you move into this, I suppose, a corporate finance position, and you spend a little bit of time as an independent expert applying your accounting knowledge. I imagine there are a few late nights, but some interesting things coming across your desk.
Yeah. So lots of late nights and lots of tight deadlines.
Mm-hmm.
Working with private equity on due diligence for acquisitions they're looking at making,
mm-hmm.
and also the expert reports for when ASX companies were subject to takeover bids. We'd come in and provide an independent expert valuation to work out if that takeover bid was fair and reasonable. So, look, it was fast paced. There was lots of travel, lots of exposure to interesting industries and deals and people, businesses. So, a really good few years.
I imagine it would have been wonderful to get a foothold in that industry and learn what goes on behind the scenes in some of these deals that we see in the news headlines. Many of our listeners perhaps have had experience in private equity or corporate finance, or potentially want to move into that industry. What advice would you have for them? And I suppose the point I'm getting at here is, why did you move from that into into the share market and public equities?
In my experience, the best private equity operators are those individuals that have the right balance of commercial and business experience and technical accounting and finance skills. So it's getting that mix of practice and theory is really important.
Mm-hmm.
It's not all about working your way up as a graduate through a professional services firm. I think you need a broader skill set than that, and those that can have that, with a variety of experiences and perspectives to draw on are very valuable for someone looking for success in that field.
That makes sense. It's certainly with the pay packet, it's a very alluring industry to be in. I'm hoping, because I assume it was around this time that things were starting to get a bit shaky in global markets and throughout the GFC, 2008-2009. Were you investing in public or private companies at this stage as well?
Yeah, so I was at that time I was still working in corporate finance,
mm-hmm.
and it was tough. Work had dried up completely. There was no capital around. No one was doing. Mm. No one had funds to do any deals, and colleagues were made redundant. I was cut back to a 4-day week, so that was a 20% pay cut.
Yeah.
It really, really hit home. And at the same time, I was still investing in the markets, and every day was a red day. It just went on and on. You just didn't think it was ever going to turn around. But as with all cycles, it eventually does turn, and there's opportunities coming up the other side.
Yeah. Could you find, I suppose, comfort in the numbers? Being an accountant, could you find, a lot of people are scared away, the behavioural biases kick in at this stage. Did you find comfort in, I suppose, knowing how businesses tick them from the inside?
Yeah, you get comfort, but I was still amazed at the extent of the pricing, and then also as things started to turn, the opportunities that were then available, because you had businesses trading on so low multiples, and businesses or companies that trading less than cash backing in lots of instances. So that the situation created a number of really, really interesting opportunities.
I can imagine. That's great. Great segue into what I suppose came next for you professionally. I suppose the inception of DMX. Can you explain what DMX is and where it is today and where it started?
Yes. So well. DMX actually came from Dollar Mattress Corporation, which was an ASX listed company.
Mm-hmm.
I had been a shareholder in DMX Corporation, or in Dollar Mattress, for a number of years. I think around 2012, I recall, that was subject to a takeover offer by a waste management company, Tox3 Solutions. Mm-hmm. So Dollar Mattress was also a waste management company, and eventually sold its assets to competitor Tox3 Solutions. That left Dollar Mattress, or DMX, was its ASX ticker code, as a cashed up shell, and it was recapitalized by a Roger Collison, John Welsh, and Michael Haddad, who are three all involved in the financial services field. Mm-hmm. They then began looking for fund management opportunities. They'd secured an AFSL license, mm-hmm. and I was a shareholder. I was receiving their quarterly updates and their annual reports, and saw an opportunity to pitch to them a value-based micro-cap strategy. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, providing investors exposure to interesting opportunities in under-owned, hard-to-access mm-hmm. asset class.
So for you personally, was that a tough decision to make to forego what I can tell, perhaps a lucrative career and step into your own business, I suppose?
Yeah, it was not something I took lightly, but anyway, mm. I saw the opportunity. I, over the years, had built up from investing a capital base that allowed me the opportunity to do other things and not having to work for a corporate employer. Mm. So this was a really great opportunity for me, and I was also something that was really important to me was, as a retail investor, I always thought it was really unfair that privileged broker clients got access to cheap discounted lines of stock and to discounted placements and the really good allocations and IPOs. And I thought, you know, this is not a level playing field. And I really wanted to put a vehicle together that provided investors with, albeit an indirect exposure to those sorts of opportunities. Mm. And yeah, that's pleased us to how it turned out, and then we are able to access those opportunities that are really hard for most investors out there to get access to.
Yeah, they are. I think it's great, and the performance to date has been impressive. Let's move into your investment process now, and to start, I think let's consider where you choose to fish with the money that you have available to invest, and why you do that. You invest in Australian smaller micro caps, and typically when we say smaller micro caps, we mean anything well below $500 million in value and substantially less so. Let's just start with why do you invest in that arena?
Yeah, so our sweet spot's probably it's 10 mil to 100 mil. Mm-hmm. We do go up to 500 mil, but it's really, we really like that sort of 10 to sort of 75, 100 space.
Yep.
Because it we see opportunities there where others are perhaps turned off from investing in smaller liquid companies. And when we see that as an opportunity to buy growing under the radar businesses mm-hmm. on really attractive valuations, because there's not a lot of natural buyers there. No one else is really interested in investing in those sorts of opportunities. They are normally very illiquid, mm-hmm. and in this market, most investors want liquidity and short-term focus. They want to be able to get in and out and trade the news flow, etc. And you just can't do that with a lot of these opportunities. So that means that you have to have a long-term perspective, which we do, mm-hmm. and you have to be comfortable taking on the being invested in stocks which have limited liquidity, yeah. And we're comfortable doing that. So there's we see it as an opportunity where others see risks,
yeah.
And that means, you know, we can see help some of these small businesses that are doing good things, that are growing, that are profitable, and we can provide capital to these small businesses, help them on their journey to grow, mm-hmm. and that's something we're really pleased to do.
I think particularly in the small cap space, there's potential for the informational advantage, you know, if you can access that, and particularly if you've got the analytical ability and the behavioural edge is there, obviously, if you can invest long term. One of the interesting things is that there's quite a substantial tail on the Australian share market. There's, in your universe, I would say, more than 1,000 small companies. Can you explain how you get from that 1,000 down to a more manageable list for you and the team?
Yeah, so we're first and foremost value-based investors, so we have to be able to get comfortable with evaluation and margin of safety before we invest. So that means we prefer companies that are profitable, mm-hmm. and probably of that 1,000, maybe 10% are profitable. And we also like companies that have a good track record and a good track record of generating cash flows, and that means generally paying dividends.
Mm-hmm.
So of that 100 that are profitable, maybe only two-thirds or half are paying dividends. So it is a pretty narrow universe, but that it's not a stack universe. There's companies coming and going. There's IPOs, there's transactions, there's acquisitions, there's deals. So it's not staying still, but it is ultimately quite a narrow universe.
And quite manageable, yeah. When people, and we touched on this earlier, when people think about small caps in Australia, they tend to think about speculative investments, biotechs, resources, technology companies. These are common examples. It seems to me that the companies that you hold ultimately are quite high quality. So in fact, they're potentially the opposite end of the quality spectrum. From a high level, can you explain the types of quality features you're targeting?
Yeah, so we're trying to take away as much risk as we can from investing in smaller microcaps, because they're naturally quite a risky, it's quite a risky universe. They don't have the small companies are often quite a bit key man risk. There's some startup risk. There's lack of diversification, lack of earnings resilience. There are a number of risks that we're trying to remove those risks to the extent that we're dealing with companies that are profitable. They've got a positive cash flows. There's a track record of over the years of profit that we can see,
mm-hmm.
and we can see it got good visibility around their future profit. So we're trying to stack the odds as much as we can in our favour by investing sensibly, by not taking on risk around startups, around commercialisation of technology not coming through, around exploration not coming off, biotechs not delivering the results they need to, and really focusing on good businesses run by good people that have good prospects.
Yeah, great. There's a fantastic blog post on the DMX website where you detailed 14 investment beliefs. I'll pick out a couple of my favourites and perhaps we can jump off and discuss how these came to be your beliefs, and feel free to use any examples if you have them. So the first one was buy companies with a strong asset backing.
Yes, so companies that have a market cap valued at around or supported by the value of their net tangible assets. So, that's really interesting to us. Now, assuming those tangible assets are valued correctly, then it really provides strong downside protection, because ultimately the value of the assets should be, net assets should be worth the value of the company. And then to the extent that you've got an operating business in that company as well, you're getting the upside from that, basically getting that for free. It's an option around the success of that operating business, because you're only paying for the net assets, and that's, we find that pretty attractive.
I suppose in some ways it kind of flies in the face of a lot of the things that we hear from growth investors lately, is that you want capital light businesses that have significant operating leverage, but I can certainly see why substantial assets are important. The next one on the list was knowledge and expertise are more important than diversification.
Yeah, so we run a pretty concentrated portfolio. There's around 20 stocks in the portfolio generally.
Mm-hmm.
And we think it's more important to know a lot about a small number of companies than knowing very little about a large number of companies. And yeah, as a result, we believe that potentially the more diversified you become, the more riskier the portfolio is, because you can't devote enough time to each of the holdings to stay on top of what's happening.
The next one was rejection of the idea that volatility or standard deviation is risk.
Yeah, so businesses are dynamic. They're growing, they are making acquisitions, they're doing a lot of things that each day that change their risk profile going forward. And standard deviation is simply a backward-looking historic measure when risk should be reflecting, or an analysis of risk should reflect the future.
Absolutely. And you're preaching to the choir here. This all makes sense to me, so I take no objection to any of this. One of the key features of the high-quality businesses you target, at least it seems to me, is management. And there's a line on the DMX website that says, management quality is arguably the number one determinant of a company's long-term success. This is often best done, I find, through a qualitative rather than quantitative lens. I mean, we use both, but can you explain why management research is important and outline some of the signs that speak to management quality?
Yeah, so the reality is we're investing in small companies. There's not often not a deep management team.
Mm-hmm.
So success is very dependent on a small number, a couple of key individuals. And so there is real key man risk. So you got to have the management has to be the right management are critical.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a number of factors that help give us confidence that the right people are in charge. And obvious ones being skin in the game. We like looking at the track record of management, seeing what they said they were going to do 3 or 4 years ago. Did they follow through? Were there excuses? That's all well and good, but often it comes down to actually meeting management and eyeballing them, sitting down face to face, and just getting that gut feel. Can you trust this person to manage this company? Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes it's hard to put your finger on it.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you often get it wrong?
The biggest thing we come across is just overconfidence.
Okay, interesting.
Amongst management, and particularly if there's a turnaround or an IPO or a new management team come on board, they have come with all these great ideas, but inevitably it takes much longer than they expect, and it's a lot more challenging. But management, I think by their nature, are too overconfident, and that's something we are always aware of.
Yeah, interesting. This next point relates to the first question today about your car. There was a recent blog post on DMX website. I think it was written by your colleague Simon, who wrote about the idea that investors undervalue simplicity, and that was where the VW Golf comes in. In my opinion, we see this everywhere. We see undervaluing simplicity across the full spectrum of finance, from budgeting, gimmicks and tricks, insurance, and even picking a mortgage, to investing. We often pay a higher price for things we perceive to be more sophisticated. Can you elaborate on why people often underpay for simplicity, and perhaps how some of the things, or how DMX stands to benefit from this bias?
Yeah, look, I think when it comes to investing, there's a real thrill or excitement factor around thinking that you might be part of the next big thing, mm-hmm. the next 10-bagger. You start thinking about the new car you'll get, or the holiday you'll take if the stock penny dreadful that you're in goes up 20 times, and that's all well and good. And I think that the valuation of a stock that's not making money is the earnings are it's not constrained by its current earnings, so people can think of the blue sky, possibility of taking this new tech business, taking it
the next Amazon,
25%, 30%, 40% market share. But the reality is that the chances of it coming off and before is very remote, and there's likely to be numerous capital raisings and dilutions along the way until reality finally hits home and there's a significant disappointment risk. On the other hand, you've got a business making widgets, making 10% growth a year, far less exciting, far less hype built into the share price, but I can be pretty confident that widget making company over the next 10 years is going to generate far superior cash flows than the hot spec stock. And at the end of the day, over a long period of time, those cash flows are what generates shareholder wealth. So the opportunity to buy those sorts of businesses relatively cheap is very attractive, because they are the ones that are going to be generating the far superior returns over the long term.
I should add that the question about cars was related to a study, which I'll link to in the show notes, about the flashy cars are typically driven by investors with a higher risk tolerance. So perhaps it's an opportunity for everyone to reflect on the car that we drive and how we invest and see if there's a connection. The next point I wanted to cover was the valuation and how you determine the value of a business. Typically, obviously, every business is different. Obviously, dividends are important to you. If you could use an example, by all means.
Yeah, look, we use discounted cash flows when we're valuing our holdings. We're adopting realistic assumptions. We're adopting 5-10% sales growth, and we're not looking at hockey stick type growth assumptions that underlie the values of some of these really high growth companies. And that provides us with comfort. We're happy making realistic assumptions. There's a stock, Fiducian FID. It's been listed 17 years, and all those 17 years, it's returned double-digit earnings growth across 15 of them or something, of them. So it's, you know, those sorts of businesses are pretty good to model, because the assumptions are, you don't have to make heroic type assumptions to support the valuation. And having done our DCF value, we also look at multiples, earnings, and enterprise value.
Yep.
And we're looking for businesses that are growing, but on lower PE multiples. So our portfolio's averaging 11 times PE versus a market 16 times.
Quite the difference.
Because we're investing in these small companies, there's the opportunity to do that, because you can buy these good businesses on low multiples, because there's not a lot of buyers out there.
How about sell discipline? Why do you find yourself selling? Do you sell when intrinsic value, when the price hits the valuation? Or?
Yeah, well, I mean, we are value investors, so we sell when the prices are materially above our valuation. Likewise, we buy when the prices are below. But you know, we also sell when we consider the thesis to be broken, or we lose confidence in management.
Mm-hmm. Do you tend to track those companies after you've sold them?
Yeah, we do.
Okay, great. Coming back to the business now and DMX and the company, where do you see yourself in the company 5 years from today, sir?
Oh, look, the most important thing for us is that we continue to look after our investors' interests, and you know, we hope to grow the business and introduce some new products at some point. But first and foremost, it's about providing good service and good long-term returns for our investors.
Yeah, great, as you have done, I might add. So where can our listeners find out more about you and DMX?
Yeah, look, so our website, dmxam.com.au, yeah, as you said, lots of information. Mm-hmm. And you can sign up there for our content. We produce a monthly newsletter and other insights and content throughout the month as well. So that's free to sign up to.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay, last question, Stephen. My favourite. If you could go back and tell the younger Stephen just one thing about investing, what would it be?
Look, I think it's just make sure you stay humble. Investing inevitably has lots of ups and downs, and you just can't afford to get complacent. But if you maintain a long-term perspective and invest sensibly, the odds are well stacked in your favour to do well.
That's wonderfully concise and great advice, mate. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast. For further episodes, head to www.raskfinance.com. To provide feedback, nominate a guest, or hear from me, you can find me on Twitter with the handle @OwenRask. Cheers to our financial futures.